Hello and welcome to The Preservationists, a monthly radio show for fans of local historic architecture, history, and the people in our community working to preserve and restore it. My name is Astronomist Ray, and I'm a board member and the vice president of Lower Columbia Preservation Society, LCPS, and your host of The Preservationists. Today, I'm joined by Quinn Hayes of the Masonic Temple. Quinn, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thank you for asking.
How long have you been a part of the Seaport Masonic Lodge? How many years have you been with this organization?
Yeah, I first joined Freemasonry in Portland about 7 years ago, and I moved here in 2020 and joined up with this local lodge, Seaport Lodge Number 7. So I've been now involved with this lodge for about 4 years.
Wonderful. And what inspired you to join?
I think like a lot of men, there's a familial connection. I had a grandfather on my mother's side who was a Freemason. He died before I was born, sadly, so I never got to know him. And that was a big draw for me, was to sort of put together a picture of who this person might have been by understanding what he was interested in, what he spent his time doing. And I was always told by my mother that he enjoyed his involvement with this organization. And so I tried to kind of recapture some of that picture of who he was by joining myself.
Yes. And would you be able to give our listeners some insights about what Freemasonry is and what is its significance in this community?
Yeah, absolutely. Freemasonry is an organization that tries to, sort of our elevator pitch often is that we make good men better. Okay. That's kind of in a nutshell what we like to say, right? There's a longer form of that. That's system of morality veiled in allegory and illustrated through the use of symbols. Which is a long-winded way of saying we use symbolic interpretation of actual Masonic work, like as in stonemasons, to impart lessons to our members that are meant to help shape them into a better individual. So that for the people that are involved and that are actually practicing Freemasonry as a speculative practice, we can be better men, not just for ourselves, but for our families, for our communities, and for our country. And so we do that in a lot of different ways, but mostly through community involvement, through charity, and we also do that in sort of lifting each other up. It's a safe space for men to kind of work on themselves and each other.
Yes, and the history of Freemasonry in this area particularly is quite significant in itself. In its history, there's been some quite notable figures involved in this temple specifically. George Flavelle and the Van Dusen family.
Absolutely.
So over the years, many, many people have been in and out of the building. This one isn't the original.
No.
It was reconstructed after the fire. Can you talk a little bit about the structure itself?
Sure. I just wanted to point out, too, that this is sort of a significant thing for the heritage of our area, is that Seaport Masonic Lodge, which originally was called Temple Lodge Number 7, the 7 denotes that we were the 7th lodge chartered within the Oregon Territory. And I say that because Oregon was not yet a state at the time that this lodge actually formed. So a story being as old as it is, right, this was one of the earliest settlements on the West Coast. It drew a lot of people here, and we were very early in the process of when lodges started to appear in the Oregon Territory. So Temple Lodge Number 7 formed in, I think, 1854. And we did, like you said, used to meet at a building downtown, which did, unfortunately, burn in the fire of 22. As I understand it, the building here might have already been in construction before the fire happened, because the completion date on this building is like somewhere around 23, I think. So it tells me a story that maybe they were in the process of already thinking about moving even before the old building burned down. I have a letter somewhere in our archives from the Grand Lodge of Oregon, which is our sort of parent body for the state. And the letter was asking for permission, because it's in our charter that we meet at a certain place at a certain time on a certain day of the week. So if we want to do something different than that, we need special permission to do so. So the Van Dusens, as you mentioned, who were prominent members at the time, had an estate over on, I believe, past 16th on Franklin Avenue. And for a temporary amount of time after the fire of 22, but before this building was finished, we had to meet in their attic of that building for a while. So a little bit interesting history about the transition there between the two. But yes, the temple that was built about just 100 years ago now that we currently occupy on Franklin Avenue in Astoria was sort of meant to be a beacon of Freemasonry on the West Coast. Lodges, historically, especially in America, typically did not occupy their own buildings. In the East Coast, it was very common for them to utilize a space above a tavern or like a meeting hall that just existed in somebody else's business. And then as they started to purchase their own buildings, they kind of copied that model with the idea of a business being on the bottom floor and the lodge being on the top floor. That way they had generated income to support the organization. It was pretty uncommon for Freemasons to have a building that was solely just for the fraternity itself. So there are, of course, a number of examples of these all across the United States, one of the more magnificent ones being in downtown Detroit, which is the largest, I think, Masonic building in the United States. But there wasn't a lot of that kind of stuff here on the West Coast 100 years ago when this was being built. It was built as a way of housing not just one part of the fraternity, but of all parts of the fraternity. So we had a lot of sister organizations and appendant bodies that met in the building as well. Very shortly after Temple Lodge formed, another lodge formed here in Astoria too, and they both shared the building. So they would use it on different nights of the week. We had Temple Lodge number 7 and Harbor Lodge 183. In addition to those two Masonic organizations, there was the Sorority, the Order of the Eastern Star. There was the Scottish Rite, the York Rite chapters, like the Commandery, the Shrine, and all the youth groups that we usually maintained, like D. Malay, Rainbow Girls, Bethel, Job's Daughters. So you can imagine, 100 years ago, this giant building has been built, right, to house all these different chapters. Every night of the week, there probably would have been somebody using the building. As time went on, each of these chapters sort of slowly disappeared, and we're sort of left as the sole occupier now. And we are actually a combination of the two lodges that once met there, Temple Lodge and Harbor Lodge, formed in 1993 to become Seaport Lodge number 7, who we are today.
Yeah, and you know, you mentioned like the revenue of the space. Now, with these Masonic Temple Lodges, their revenue comes from member dues. And the other source of revenue is kind of events and, you know, the things that happen there, like the high school dances and the weddings. That's kind of rented out space.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with your space now, it's not able to be rented, correct?
Yeah, the city has made sure that we know that it is not okay right now for us to be able to rent the building to an outside party. We can occupy it, we can use it for our own uses, but we're not allowed to rent it to somebody who's not a Mason for an outside event. And that, like you said, it has to do mostly with safety issues concerning the front of the building where the entrance is and the pillar. But yes, this one historically would have made its money, right, by using that sort of grand hall that's on the base floor of it for proms, like you said, and homecomings, for wedding receptions and parties, Christmas events, right? Whether those were either organized through us as an event for us or our members of the family or the town, or rented out for revenue.
Yes, and what are some of the contributing factors that are making it challenging to restore this building? Is it weather, water damage? I know you had mentioned deferred maintenance too as well in an article.
Yeah. And it's not just like, you know, somebody was ignoring a problem that was there and that's what's led to this. You have to also understand contextually the history of this thing. When this building was being built 100 years ago, Flavelle's family, the Van Dusen family, a number of the prominent families in the town would have passed around the hat and thrown in checks of their own, right? So the personal assets and wealth of some of the more prominent members is what built the version of Freemasonry that was really peaking in the 1950s and 60s. Since then, because the average wage, I would imagine, of a man in the 21st century has shrunk considerably, and what they have, the access to wealth that they have has changed dramatically, it's a little harder for us to lean on the members as a way of doing so. You know, you mentioned dues as being a way to sort of bring in some revenue, and that's probably a good model so long as your dues are actually reflecting what the needs of the building are, right? Our dues are $50 a year times 60-something members that we have, right? It's not really a lot of money. And there was a peak in the 50s and 60s in membership when that started to decline. I think Masons tried to, like, probably not just us, but probably every other fraternal society, including what we call the animal lodges, the moose, the elks, the lions, right? The odd fellows, a number of them, to remove a deterrent from joining, right? Maybe the financial part of it for some people was keeping them away. So they decided to not raise the dues to keep up with the times, right? If we were paying the equivalent dues of what a man in, let's just say, 1920 was paying, right? We'd be paying a lot more in dues to support the organization. So, you know, we've had two things that are kind of happening. You've got the building itself, which you're right, is situated in a place where the weather can be pretty extreme, right? Where the salty air kind of eats away at a lot of these buildings. And due to the way it was built, right, this Greek revival structure that they decided to land on design-wise, it has a lot of specific needs, and it was crafted in a very specific way that's not really normal for this area, I would say. And so there's some really unique needs that it has for just a structure, as just a building. But the building isn't technically the lodge. We're the lodge, the members, right? Wherever we meet, we are a lodge of Masons. We've also, not just the whole organization as a trend, has seen a decline in membership, but because we've been a membership made up mostly of elderly people, people who were really involved back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, our average age, I think, of membership is in the 80s still. And unfortunately, just because time moves on, we've seen a dramatic decline within the last just 4 or 5 years as members have passed on, because there's just been a lot of historically quite old people that have been a part of this organization. So trying to find people around my age, I'm about 40 years old, trying to get people that are more, you know, have the time and energy to be able to help with something like revitalizing, not just the structure, not just looking for people to help with the actual fundraising, let's say, to restore a building, but also to sort of restore the culture of the lodge, to restore, you know, who we are as an organization, and to make sure that that's a modern organization that's attractive to a younger man and that we have something to offer the community. So that had been my focus when I got here, was really trying to shape up the interior of the organization, as well as try to help the building when I could.
Exactly. And, you know, there has been past restoration and preservation efforts to this building, and some of them were more recently. Can you tell me a little bit further about what exactly happened with those efforts?
Yeah. If you look back in the archives, you'll find some papers, I think probably from the historian, the Daily A, back in about 1979, 1980. That was the last time that the Masons really got together and organized something like a remodel. Okay. At that time, there were still multiple organizations that occupied the building. What they wound up doing was they formed a temple board, a temple association, and they sort of essentially sold shares of ownership of the building to each of those organizations that used the building, right, in exchange for that money that they would then use to help revitalize the entire building. So about 1980, they had something like a facelift. I think it was something between $50,000 and $80,000 is what they wound up putting into the building. Since then, we haven't seen a major effort to be able to keep up with the maintenance or to restore the building until I got there and started trying to connect us with broader resources. So I did utilize a couple of grants. Some of those are done by the Grand Lodge of Oregon, where they have a sort of a 50-50 match grant for lodge restoration up to $10,000 per project. So we were able to, say, replace the double doors on the west side of the building where water was getting under the door when it would rain significantly. Okay, so that was a project I utilized grant funding for to be able to get that going. And then I also took advantage of a grant from the state, as you mentioned, I think in 2022. And that was the Preserving Oregon grant, which was specifically dog-eared to help maintain historic structures. And we had been noticing a fair amount of water coming in from somewhere near the roof that was leaking down into the building. And so after consulting with multiple contractors and various people from the college, for example, I work a lot with Lucian and John at Clatsop Community College's Historical Preservation Program, invaluable resources to me. The Lower Columbia, as you mentioned, you're involved with, invaluable resource to me, because I knew nothing about this coming into it, right? So I'm kind of coming into this blind and trying to figure out, is there anything I can do to make this work? So I was able to secure a $20,000 matched grant from that Preserving Oregon grant. $20,000 is not a small amount of money to my organization. So I looked at other lodges in the state to see if they would be willing to contribute to make up that match portion. And I was successful. I got two different lodges to donate about $10,000 each. So we had our $40,000 to work with. Now that sounds like it could be a significant amount of money, but compared to the problems the building is facing, you can't really accomplish that much. And I think that's been one of the biggest challenges that we currently face, is that just the price tag of tackling even the most significant of the damage that's been done to the building is a bit preventative, because we don't have access to enough capital to even match a lot of those grant funds. In addition to that, we are a 501c10, not a 501c3. A lot of grants only award to 501c3s. In addition to that, if we were to say prominent members of this community who might have access to more wealth as a donation, a lot of those are looking at it as a tax deductible donation, which makes sense. But you can't get a tax deduction from donating to a 501c10. So we're kind of tied in a lot of ways because we don't have the regular access to restoration efforts that a lot of organizations do. And it's due to the sort of unique nature of what this organization has found itself as and is defined as. And even working with contractors, working with people who are looking up city codes and things like that, I've come across there's a lot of question marks. Like it must have been a challenge, especially in the modern era, as people wanted to seek to define things more. It became a bit of a challenge to, like, what is this organization? What does it do? And where do we categorize that? We're not a religion. We're not a church, right? But we're often kind of lumped into that same category. But we're not a tax, you know, deductible, you know, 501c3 either. So we kind of fall into this weird area that makes it really hard to kind of get access to the resources we feel like we need in order to help that building survive.
We'll return back to Quinn's interview in just a moment. First, I'd like to introduce LCPS board member, Lori.
Hi. Join me, for Topics in Preservation on Wednesday, September 18th at the LCPS office at 12th and Duane at 6 p.m. I will be doing a short presentation on historic wallpaper, love it or hate it, how to remove it, and how to pick the correct historic wallpaper for your home. Please join us on Tuesday, October 8th for LCPS Presents at Pacific Distillery at the base of 4th Street and the waterfront, the Brick Warehouse. Our talk on Astoria's Auto Row begins at 7 p.m., but come early because Pacific Distillery opens at 4. The event is free and donations are welcomed. See you there.
Thank you so much, Lori. Those sound like wonderful events. Now introducing LCPS board member Eric as he talks about the LCPS Presents for November.
Oh, thank you, astronomist. Yes, we have another upcoming program at the Pacific Distillery on November 12th, and the presenter is Washington State Parks Ranger Aaron Webster, and he's going to be telling a fascinating story about the son, or perhaps grandson, of a shipwrecked English sailor. The fellow's name was George Ramsey, and the story is that he was introduced to the Lewis and Clark party at Fort Clatsop as the red-haired Indian. And so apparently he spoke a certain amount of English as well as Clatsop. So it's a one-man show. Aaron Webster is a great storyteller, so we're looking forward to that at the same venue, the Pacific Distillery on the waterfront. And that's Tuesday, November 12th at 7 o'clock.
Thank you so much, Eric. We look forward to those events. Now back to our interview with Quinn Hayes. And Quinn, just to give our listeners a perspective, how many members exactly do you guys have, roughly?
Something around 60 or so members on the books. A lot of those people are just men who they probably don't even live here in Astoria or even maybe even in Oregon, but they still maintain their membership, they pay their dues, or they have a lifetime membership, so they're considered part of our membership, right? But I would say for us, a good night when it comes to attendance at, say, our monthly meetings, if we get 10 to 12 guys, that's a good night. We still use it for our needs, and I've tried to encourage the membership that's still there to feel free to use the building as they see fit. So I've done game nights there just for, fun and enjoyment. I used to have an office set up there where we had Wi-Fi, so if we had members who were working from home or working remotely and they wanted a quiet space to work, there was a desk, a printer, Wi-Fi, that kind of stuff. Before the city sort of put these restrictions on us due to the nature of the damage, we were trying to partner with local organizations who we would let use the building for free rather than generate some income, because we believed in the community projects they were doing, whether that was Seth Titchener using the building for his philosophy class, which he was at for a certain period of time. We were working with a pair of therapists who were focused on community wellness, providing a meeting space for people to be able to come together as a community. And so we looked for sort of other organizations in our town that we believed in their mission, and we wanted to support those missions because we didn't necessarily have money to say give to these organizations, but we had space. And we could be generous with that space. I've still had schools ask us about the dances. I still get probably one or two emails every month asking if somebody can use it for their wedding. There's still a lot of interest from the community who remembers that this was a community space, right? And unfortunately, if this building goes away, it's not just the Freemasons that are losing the building, it's the community that loses it.
Absolutely. And, in its current state, what is it that needs to be worked on and restored? Mm-hmm. I know there's mention of potentially those column areas, that mm-hmm. Portico above it. Is that still the case, or is there other things that need to be restored?
I would say that's the number one thing, right? As far as even the city is concerned, if we wanted to go back to a place where we were able to rent the building out for the community to use, right, that's their concern. We've got to secure that front area. Now, I think an important thing, one thing, if anybody takes anything away from this interview, one thing I want everybody to know is that those columns are decorative. Those are not structural columns. They're hollow. They're just cast metal, and they're not supporting that portico you mentioned above it, right? That section of the building is cantilevered all the way to the back. So that's an important, I think, distinction, because I think people think of the safety. Of course, if a giant, even hollow metal column came crashing down, that's a potential safety risk, and that is reasonable. But I think maybe people think it's a little more desperate than it is when it comes to what those columns do. But yes, those hollow metal columns kind of pose a significant problem. The bulk of the structure is reinforced concrete, and that's a relatively sound structure when it comes to weathering this atmosphere, right? That portico in particular, though, that comes out from the front of the building was framed in wood rather than concrete like the rest of the building, which means as rain has gotten inside it, it's compromised more of that structure. As we've talked to contractors and structural engineers and architects, which I've consulted with often over the years, the design sort of becomes one that we really, if we really want to preserve the building and get it back to a place where we can open it up to the public, that whole front portico section needs to be removed and completely rebuilt. As I'm sure you're aware, due to its historic designation, that means it would have to be done historically accurate, which makes it that much more difficult to find people who can do that work, right? Who's going to make giant columns like that? You know, yeah. I actually contacted, believe it or not, I contacted the company that made them 100 years ago, which is still in existence. I want to say they're in Canton, Ohio, and the Lower Columbia had shown me an ad that this company, this U.S. Steel company or something like that, you know, had put our building in the ad as like, hey, do you need giant columns for your building? Like, look here. And I contact them being like, maybe we can still work together. Wouldn't that be cool if 100 years later, the same company that made those columns for us comes back and helps us with the restoration effort? That company had been bought out by another larger company some years ago and doesn't do that kind of work anymore. But certainly exploring those avenues. That front porch, that portico is probably our biggest barrier. And it's not a small price tag from just the rough estimates and quotes that I've seen about what that would take for us to completely remove that front of the part of the building and then completely rebuild it up again. And if we took it away, we would lose the historical nature of the building. Oddly enough, and this is probably the saddest thing I've had to realize in a while, is that the restrictions about demolishing historical structures is actually easier for us to overcome than the restrictions to restore a historical structure, which is very unfortunate.
Yeah, it's an unfortunate kind of choice and ultimatum in that sense. Throughout the years, you know, obviously those restoration efforts have been put into place a little bit. But is there any future plans or initiatives that are ongoing? Anything active happening? Are you guys still applying for grants or anything or things?
Sure. And as I mentioned, my focus has been twofold. It's been more centered around the organization internally. Like, who are we? Are we relevant? Are we necessary in Astoria in the 21st century, right? And that has always been, to me, the more key. I've tried to get the membership to understand, again, separating that idea of the building as the lodge. The building is not the lodge. It's a building. It's a lodge building or a temple building. We're the lodge, right? And if we were a strong group, we could survive losing that building. In fact, my lodge in Portland that I originally belonged to had such a thing. They sold their building in the early aughts. They currently occupy sharing another lodge, right, where they pay rent to stay in that building and are eventually looking to buy their own building. So they had their own strife and tribulations that cost them things, and it was a lot of restructuring. But today, you know, that lodge is doing really well, and they have access to the capital that they need should they want to, say, buy a building in the future. So it can be done, and I've seen it been done multiple times throughout not just masonry in Oregon, but throughout the United States. So I've always kind of placed a little more importance on my role of what I can bring to this organization is trying to modernize and restructure the internal organization. But I also recognize that we need this space because this is our responsibility, right? So they've sort of taken up two different kind of columns for me of what I'm trying to accomplish. And I spent a lot of energy and time through the years writing that grant and finding access to the and partnering with other organizations, doing a lot of that kind of PR stuff. That was taking up a lot of my time, and I realized I wasn't really getting the focus that I wanted on the group. I should mention as well, my role within this organization, right, is what we call it the worshipful master. It's the elected leader of the lodge. Okay. It would be synonymous to a president of an organization. Okay. So it sort of falls on me to make some decisions on behalf of the lodge, but we're ultimately a democracy, right? We vote together. So I wouldn't necessarily use that authority to overstep my bounds, right? We make decisions as a group. So I want to make sure that we have a sense of harmony before we make dramatic decisions about what. And that's been another area that's taking up a lot of my time and energy is sort of working on that interior culture. And we've had some gains, we've had some losses, both with the lodge as a group of men and with the building itself. It's a lot for one person, right? If we had 10 of me, we might be in a different situation, but it's not. I recognize I have a privilege that maybe not every member of my organization has. And the experience that I've had both in masonry and other parts of my life have given me a skill set that I can do these kind of things. So I do them because I saw that need and I wanted to fill it. I would like people to know that we are not a religion, which I think some people might be confused about. I think some other common misconceptions, and I said this as I had a familial connection, but a lot of people wrongly think that you have to be related to somebody to be able to join, somebody who is a Mason, and that's not true. In fact, that was something my mom told me, so it was something she herself was incorrect about when she informed me that. You don't have to be related to a Mason to join Freemasonry. We do have certain requirements, of course. We ask that the person, you know, pass a background check and things like that, right? And we have to, you know, kind of interview you to make sure you're a good fit for the culture of the lodge, you know, and you have to be over a certain age and things like that. But I think it's most important for people to understand is that we accept people of all walks of life, right? We are to regard everybody as equal.
And that leads into my next question. What would be the impact if this structure was able to be revitalized?
Sure. There's the history as it relates to Masonry, but there's the history just as it relates to Astoria, because as you mentioned, so many famous now historic legends were involved in my organization as well. So those histories are intertwined, right? And they always will be. So we're preserving that part as well. Like you said, there's the community element to it, right? Not only historically has it been used for community, but I knew, for example, somebody I know reached out to me who worked at a daycare who was losing access to the space that they had, asked if they could house a daycare in the lodge. I wish we were in a place where we could support something like that, because that would be absolutely part of our mission and part of what we want to do. In addition, we had a certain amount of our assets that were dog-eared for a scholarship for the nurses program at Clatsop Community College. When I got there, I noticed that that number was never changing, meaning we weren't actually giving out any of that money. And I wanted to know why. And so it seemed like the man that was in particular responsible for sort of shepherding and making that happen, he had passed on and nobody really knew how to get it going again. So I took the initiative to get that reconnected and start that back up again. In a healthy functioning lodge, a huge portion of what we do is meant to be charity, but we have to have strong membership. We have to have, you know, our dues reflect modern times, and we have to have some sort of access to capital so that we can not just make our space charitable, but we can also use those dollars and that energy and that time, right, to support the organizations that we believe in. And so, you know, you look at the one in Warrenton, Gateway Lodge, they have this amazing scholarship program for the high school students to give them money to start out in college. And they award a ton of money every year to that cause. That was all possible because one member left a significant amount, right? So with good, strong membership, that energy and that money is going to get reinvested in the community. So if we not just revitalize the building for the community's use, but if we're able to revitalize the lodge, that's going to equal more community service, more charity, more civil service.
That's wonderful. Is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I would just say if this is something that is interesting to you, you know, reach out to us. We do have a website, seaportmasoniclodge.com. And, you know, right now we're not able to rent out the building, but I'm still certainly showing it to a lot of people because I think that being able to have access to it, which is not something people historically had, they felt that it was maybe off limits to them. I give tours all the time. I just did one a couple days ago. I'm doing one for some of the people that we got the grant from the Oregon State Office in October. So if people just want to see the building and kind of understand some more of the history of that building, maybe that motivates the community to rally around this. And it can be done. I mean, let's look at the amazing efforts that were done with the Liberty Theater. Or with the old Oddfellows building, another fraternal building that, yes, the Oddfellows had since left, but that building was able to be saved and revitalized. These things can be done. It's not insurmountable. We can do it if we rally together as a community.
Thank you for tuning in to this month's episode of The Preservationist. The Preservationist airs every third Tuesday of the month on KMUN at 9:30 a.m. I'd like to give a special thanks to my guest for this month, Quinn Hayes from the Masonic Temple. Thank you to the team here at KMUN, the staff, members, and volunteers of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society, and a special thanks to Camila Swerdloff for producing the theme song for The Preservationist. And thank you for listening to The Preservationist. And remember, anyone can be a preservationist. The Preservationist is a production of the Lower Columbia Preservation Society for KMUN, written and produced by Astronomist Ray. Until next time, I'm Astronomist Ray. Thanks for tuning in.